Thank you again for tuning in to the radio program Go and Teach that's sponsored by the Monte Vista Church of Christ. We're going to be studying from Mark chapter 14. If you'd like to follow along, Mark chapter 14. I'm not the normal voice on this program, but I fill in about every third week or so. And when I do come on the radio, for the most part, I've been dedicating these addresses to preaching through the Gospel of Mark. The main reason for this was to challenge my own self at first when I set out to preach through the Gospel of Mark, but it's turned into something different. After doing an in-depth study, or fairly in-depth, I should say, I'm convinced that there is no more powerful evidence that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, than the internal evidence of these gospel records. They were written that we might believe. They were written that we would look at his life, his dealings with mankind, his teachings, his miracles, and that we would walk away totally convinced that Jesus could not have been anything other than God's Son. We want you to believe that, and that's partly why we even do this radio program. So the 14th chapter of Mark is by far the longest chapter in Mark. It has a lot to say about the betrayal of Jesus and the subsequent arrest of Jesus. The Gethsemane account, which is very popular, is in this particular chapter. But before we get into the betrayals of Judas, denials of Peter, Gethsemane, arrest, etc., we are given some background at the beginning of Mark chapter 14 concerning what time of the year it was, the Jewish festivals and holidays that were going on, and the thinking behind the enemies of Christ. The first two verses of Mark 14 read this way. Now the feast of the Passover and the unleavened bread was 2 days off, and the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to seize him by stealth and kill him. For they were saying, not during the festival, lest there be a riot of the people. So the first two verses indicate the plan was to arrest Jesus. That plan has already been hatched. As a matter of fact, the plan to seize Christ had already been a plan from a few days prior to this one. We're told in chapter 12, verse 12, that they sought an opportunity to seize Christ after he had told the parable of the tenants as a lesson that the Jews had a track record of rejecting God's prophets, and ultimately the Jews would reject God's Son. But this time, this is the first time that we're told that their intent was not just to arrest and seize, their intent is to kill Jesus. But we're told that they had a fear about what time of the year it was. It was Passover time. It was the week of unleavened bread. The two festivals were very, very popular, especially Passover, and so Jerusalem would have been crawling with Jews at this particular time. The Jews from all over the planet would have been in town paying their respects, doing the Passover thing. But not only were there Jews in town, just about every main government, Roman government official would have been in town. Roman soldiers would have been crawling all over the place. If you read some of the history of Jewish Passover feasts during the reign of the Romans, you'll find out that the Romans were always very cautious about Jewish uprisings during the festivals, because Jewish, you know, religious heritage would have been coursing through their veins. Religious pride would have been high. Religious zeal would have been very high during a festival like this. And if you combine that heritage and pride and zeal with all of the numbers coming into town, the number of people, all of a sudden you can have a real problem on your hands if you're the Romans. I say all that to emphasize why some of the Jewish religious leaders would have been scared about arresting Jesus and causing a problem, because Jesus was a beloved man by the common man, and anything that resembled an uprising would have been squelched by the Roman authorities. So the Jewish religious leaders seeking to kill Christ, they say in verse 2, not during the festival, we don't want an uprising. Well, guess when they ended up putting Jesus to death? During the festival. At first, they didn't want that, but there are some things that happen in this chapter that kind of speed up their timeline a bit. But really and truly, folks, it's God's timeline that's going to be adhered to. It was in the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God that his Son would die on Passover and be that Passover lamb for all the world. I don't want it to sound like a coincidence that the timeline was sped up, because really, the people aren't in control. God is. God's orchestrating this sacrifice. And that's not to say that God is forcing anyone to do anything. He's simply using their decisions and their heart and their rejection of Jesus to his glory and our benefit. It's what we talked about when we talked about in Mark chapter 12, that God can use the rejection of Jesus to make Jesus the cornerstone. God can use their rejection to his glory. So that's the timeline. It was just before Passover and just before the week of unleavened bread, and that's the plan of the enemies of Christ. Now we're told where Jesus was having a meal a couple of days before the festival. He's at Simon the leper's house in Bethany. We know very little about Simon the leper or his house. I suppose it's not really important, because what's important is what happened at the house. There's a woman at Simon's house where Jesus was, and she breaks a vial of costly perfume and she pours it all over Jesus' head and feet. So costly that the perfume is worth about $50,000. At least that's what it would have been worth in our U.S. currency or round about there. We're told in the text that it was worth more than 300 denarii. So roughly about $50,000, let's say. So what in the world is a woman doing breaking open 50 G's of perfume and pouring it over Jesus' body? That's the question the apostles wanted to know too. Verse 4 of chapter 14 says they were indignantly remarking to each other about the waste of money that was. And in verse 5, we're told the apostles even start scolding the woman. What are you doing? Wasting so much money and perfume like that. We could have sold that perfume. The apostles even remarked that good works could have been done with that $50,000. They say in verse 5 that it could have been sold and given to the poor. Sounds like a righteous argument from the apostles, doesn't it? Sounds reasonable, doesn't it? If I saw $50,000 getting used up in a matter of seconds, I suppose I would be scratching my head about how wise that would be too. But I want you to notice the response of Jesus. He starts scolding the apostles for scolding her. He scolds the apostles even though the apostles were perhaps thinking about poor people being helped out. His take on the event, Jesus' take on the event, is that she's done something marvelous. Verse 6, Jesus says, "Let her alone. Why do you bother her? She has done a good deed to me." Well, what could possibly be good about dousing Jesus with $50,000 of perfume? Not only is it reasonable to ask why that's a good deed, but if Jesus is concerned about good deeds, why would it have been wrong to use that money for the poor, like the apostles talked about? Well, verse 7 and 8 shed a little bit of light. Verse 7, Jesus goes on to say, "For the poor you always have with you, and whenever you wish, you can do them good. But you do not always have me." So now we're starting to see a little bit of the logic of Jesus. Jesus is hinting that I'm not going to be around very much longer, and any good to me needs to be done soon. Whereas the poor, you can do them good whenever you want. They'll always be with you. And evidently, Jesus was not the only one who knew that he was going to die and not be with them very much longer. The woman knew that. She knew Jesus was going to die, and verse 8 makes this even clearer. Verse 8 of chapter 14, he says, "She has done what she could," and now note, listen to this, "She has anointed my body for burial." She was doing the work of an undertaker. In other words, this perfume, this anointing, is the work an undertaker does. Essentially, she's embalming Jesus. Now, embalming process has come a long way, or so I'm told. I'm not a burial expert, never worked as an undertaker. But in the culture of Jesus, during the first century, the embalming process was nothing more than making a body smell as good as possible for as long as possible by putting these scents and spices and nards, very, very strong perfumes, on a body to prevent the smell of deteriorating flesh. So, isn't this amazing faith by this lady? She's using embalming perfume that costs a lot of money as a sign of saying, "I know you're about to die and be buried." Now, Jesus didn't die for another 36 hours or so from this event, because I think this is Wednesday, and he dies on Friday. But you know, it's not so much about the embalming that she's figuratively doing or literally doing. It's more about the woman's faith that she has. She's been listening to Jesus and she has believed Jesus at his word. Simple, trusting faith that we should all have. You know, Jesus has practically had to knock the disciples over the head with a club to get them to realize about what he's been saying about his death, burial, and resurrection. And you can make the argument that they still don't get it. And here you have a woman who gets it. She has accepted the truth. She hasn't explained it away or tossed it out as Jesus just being mysterious. She has trusted the simple words of Jesus like we should all strive to imitate, and acknowledge that this man is going to die soon and I'm getting him ready for burial. What an act of faith. So incredible is this woman's faith that Jesus says this woman, what she has done, will never be forgotten. Verse 9 of chapter 14, Jesus says, wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, that also which this woman has done shall be spoken of her in her memory. She will never be forgotten, Jesus says, as long as the gospel is preached. That's a strong statement, isn't it? Here we are on the radio in Phoenix, Arizona, talking about what this woman did. But of all the people surrounding Jesus, of all the people that Jesus had told that he will die, be buried, raised the third day, of all the Jews that had access to the Old Testament prophecies about his dying, the Messiah's dying, you start adding them up, all the people that have been exposed to the idea of Jesus dying, and it's truly remarkable that she got it to the point where she was willing to act on it. She believed this so strongly. One last point about this woman before we go on in the text. The point is subtle, but very important to me. This woman did what she could when she could. Let me repeat that. She did what she could when she could. You know, there's good evidence to show that this is the last night this woman would have ever been around Jesus prior to his execution. You just trace out the timeline. The next day, Jesus has his disciples prepare the Passover. They meet in the upper room. They have this Last Supper. He institutes the Lord's Supper. He leaves. He goes out to Gethsemane. He prays. He's arrested. He spends much of the night in trials. He spends much of the next morning in trials. And then the beating commences and the crucifixion commences. Now, given that timeline, what other time does this woman have to anoint his body for burial? Jesus said, she's doing this while I'm around, while she still has me. She's done what she could and did it while I was still around. If I had to paraphrase, she did what she could when she could do it. Sounds like something we should take to heart. You know, we're not all going to live 80 plus years of life. Life is a vapor and we have no idea when it's going out. Do what you can when you can. As a young parent, you know, this touches my heart. We will not all have our kids around as long as some people. You know, and when they leave their house, when they leave our house, who knows what kind of influence we will have on them. Do what you can when you can. We will not all have the time to obey the gospel and live for God. Do what you can when you can. We will not all have the influences over our friends or our loved ones. Do what you can when you can. And this woman's doing that. She did what she could when she could. What Mark brings up next is the most infamous backstabber in the history of mankind, Judas Iscariot. We're told about the first time Judas takes action to betray Jesus. Judas' betrayal of Jesus was not spontaneous. It was not something that Judas did in some moment of weakness, nor was it something that the chief priests approached Judas about, like you might expect. You might expect the leaders to approach the disciples and ask them, hey, you know, who's willing to sell out Jesus? But what Mark indicates, as well as Matthew and Luke, is that this was something completely thought out. It was something completely premeditated, completely initiated by Judas, a planned backstabbing. Verse 10 and 11 of chapter 14 read this way, "And Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went out to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. And they were glad when they heard this and promised to give him money. And he began seeking how to betray him at an opportune time." So Judas approaches the chief priests about betraying Jesus. Talk about elation on their part. You know, the text says they were glad when they heard this. I'm sure they were. They just found their golden ticket. You know, they found what they were looking for. Verse 1 of this chapter said that they were looking for a way to seize Christ. And what do you know? The opportunity came to them, dropped right in their lap. This is what I was referring to earlier at the beginning of the program when I said that some of the events in this chapter kind of speed up the timeline of the leaders, and namely the offer of Judas. So the plan is in place. They have their betrayer. They've promised money. Judas, we know from other accounts, was a money lover, so they've almost got a sure thing. All they need now is a quiet place away from all the crowds to arrest this man, which they will find in the place of a garden later on in this chapter. Chapter 14, verse 12 now says, "And on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, when the Passover lamb was being sacrificed." Okay, so now this is Thursday, the day before Jesus is executed. Verse 12 kind of marks Thursday. Thursday was the first day of the Unleavened Bread Feast. And that was a week-long feast. It was the day previous to Passover. Passover would be Friday this particular year. Typically, the day they would prepare the Passover was, you know, Thursday. Thursday was the day you selected your lamb to be slaughtered. You prepare the feast for Friday, and on Friday you put up the blood of this animal over the doorpost to commemorate the great deliverance from Egyptian bondage the night when God killed the firstborn in Egypt, unless they had this blood over their doorposts. Knowing then that Thursday was the day to prepare the Passover, the apostles naturally asked Jesus, "Well, where do you want this Passover to be prepared? Where will we take the feast?" And what Jesus does next is he tasks two disciples, tells them to go into the city, and you'll find a man there carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him, and wherever he enters, say to the owner of that house, "The teacher says, where is my guest room in which I may eat the Passover with my disciples?" There, Jesus says, "The owner of the house will show you a large upper room, furnished and ready. Prepare for us there." So the two disciples that Jesus asked to do this, they go into town, and the text says they found it just as Jesus told them, just right down to the itty-bitty details as Jesus told them. They saw the man carrying the pitcher of water. They followed this person. They found the owner. They found his master. They found an upper room that he was willing to lend out, so on and so forth. It's kind of a strange miracle, but it's no less a miracle than all the other signs Jesus has performed throughout this book. Jesus performed a very similar miracle, if you recall, just a few chapters ago in chapter 11, when Jesus sent his disciples into town to find a colt on which no one had ever sat before, and that they were told to find the owner of that colt, and that the master, to tell the owner of that colt that the master had need of it. They went into town and found that scenario exactly as Christ predicted. Quite an amazing thing. When you look at the fine details that Christ has knowledge of, you know, he knows where people will be at certain times of the day, what they will be carrying, like a pitcher of water, what animal will be there, like a colt, who has sat on that animal, you know, a colt that no one has ever sat on, a master having an upper room. It just amazing, the minute detail that Christ is predicting. And these are the moments and the passages that I was referring to at the beginning of the program when I said that the gospel records of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the greatest evidence for Jesus being God's Son. No other explanation can be given when Jesus makes predictions like these, unless you just want to throw out the Bible altogether. Well, another prediction is made in the verses following. This time it would be another dark and gloomy prediction about one of the 12 betraying him. verse 17 says, when it was evening, he came with the 12 and were reclining at table. I want you to pay special attention, please, to the fact that Mark records it was evening. If you pay special attention to the timeline, it's still Thursday. Passover wasn't supposed to be eaten until Friday. But it clearly indicates that they are taking the Passover meal on Thursday evening. Well, in our American way of thinking, yes, it would be Thursday evening. But to the Jews and the Jewish calendar, the days switched whenever the sun went down. In other words, Thursday night to a Jew would not be Thursday night, it would be Friday. Friday night would be Saturday. Saturday night would be Sunday, so on and so forth. You get the point. And that's why I wanted to make a note of the fact that Mark is pointing out that it was evening. So to Christ and the apostles, and to every other Jew for the matter, it would be Friday, and thus it was Passover. Christ is now about 12 hours away from being beaten and nailed to a cross where he will hang for about 6 hours. But during this final meal, the final Passover meal he's having with the disciples, he makes the prediction that one of the 12 would betray him. He says in verse 18 that one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me, he says. And naturally, they were sad about that. Verse 19 says that they were grieved about Jesus making that prediction. Then they started to vindicate themselves, each one, by saying, surely not I. You know, Jesus, it couldn't be me. There's absolutely no way I would betray you, Jesus. Well, they all did leave Jesus in one shape or form. I understand Jesus is talking specifically about Judas, and in the Greek language, it's a little more clear. That word betray is perhaps better understood as deliver me up. One who is eating with me will deliver me up to the authorities. And that was true. Judas would do that. But I've always found it very humbling. Listen to me, please. I've always found it very humbling that the apostles never thought it would be possible for any of them to do such a heinous act as dishonoring and turning away from Jesus. And yet, before the night's end, all of them would scatter like sheep. Verse 27, Jesus says, you will all fall away. Verse 50 says, they all left him and fled. And just a few hours before that, they're saying, well, surely not me. I can empathize with the apostles a bit here. There's been times where I would never think that I would be susceptible to certain temptations. I would never engage in an act such as fill in the blank. And yet there have been times in my life where the very thing I never thought would be possible, I did it. Where sometimes I've said, surely I will never repeat that same mistake, and then I went on to repeat it. So I want us to think a little more empathetically about these apostles, because I'm sure that all of us have made some blanket statement, either out loud or in our own minds, you know, vindicating that we would never do this or do that, or I would never repeat this. And yet, with a little bit more examination, we are rarely as strong as we think. We're rarely as strong spiritually as we think. Perhaps it would be wiser for us to pray for God's grace and strength ahead of time, that we would choose right rather than vindicating ourselves with some self-righteous attitude. But Jesus reassures them, although they had said, surely not I, right down to the last man. Jesus reassures them about his prediction in verse 20. Yes, it is one of the 12, one who dips with me in the bowl. And then in verse 21, he says it would have been better for that betrayer to have never been born. An indication, I think, of Jesus knowing that Judas would end up killing himself and never repenting of his mistake. Well, let's think a little more empathetically, shall we? Because we never always make the right decisions. We need God's grace and we need his strength. Hebrews chapter 4 says to go to the throne of grace to find strength, to help in time of need. Until next time, have a great day.